Okay, we are ready for our last talk. So please welcome John Elwood. John is the chair of the steering committee at Eden Vigil Institute of Environmental Leadership. He spent a couple decades in climate and advocacy and earned an MA in theology from Union Theological Seminary. He has recently become engaged in a relatively new field, which I'm looking forward to a definition of, ecorealism. And when he's not doing that, he's farming. You can ask him about that later. Yeah. So here you go.
Thank you, Sharon. And thank the rest of you as well for being here at this late hour of the day. It's tiring, right? You've been around a long time, but you stuck it out for this time with me. And I get to follow Sam and David, so I'm behind a couple of scientists who have lots of hard things to say, clear, pretty graphs and photographs, and now you get a theological approach. So I don't have nearly as many pretty pictures. I will be sticking pretty close to the text because I want to respect your time, and I want to leave as much time as possible for discussion afterwards, which is always the case with a theological approach to the problems that we face today. I'd also like to give thanks to my colleague, Lowell Bliss, who has traveled this journey with me. Lowell, I won't implicate you on any of the things that I say. That will be safe, I think, for you, but you have helped me wrestle with the matters that we're about to explore, and I appreciate that greatly. Today is July the 27th, almost over. 5 days from now, Thursday, is August 1st. And that's this year's Earth Overshoot Day. That's the date when humanity's demand for ecological resources and services in a given year exceeds what the Earth can produce and regenerate during that year. So as of next Friday, human consumption will be taxing the Earth in deficit. We'll be liquidating stocks of ecological resources and accumulating waste, primarily carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, effectively borrowing from the children of every species, including our own species, the resources that we consume now. It was not always this way. For almost all of human history, we lived within the boundaries of the Earth's biocapacity. When I was a senior in high school, that would be the first bar that you see on the left, actually the second. When I was a senior in high school, we'd just barely begun to demand more than the biosphere could supply. And this day fell around Christmas time. One Earth was essentially enough for us. Now, we demand 1.7 Earths for our consumption. But the aggregating the data like that can be misleading. Overshoot is also tracked by country. If all the world consumed at the rate of Americans and Canadians, deficit consuming would start on March 14th. We would need more than 5 Earths to satisfy our demand. So, I always thought that the Canadians would be way down below us, but you guys are right there with us. So I began this discussion by naming the date, not because I want to insist that things must change. Rather, things will change. Unsustainability is not a chronic but manageable condition. It will not be sustained. That's what the word means. The question I'm posing is, are we ready for what's ahead? Of course, the inevitable first response will be, well, that depends on what really is ahead. Last year at this meeting in Mississauga, I offered my assessment. I called it ecorealism, Sharon, as you wished. And I summarized it like this: for much of humanity and the interconnected web of planetary life, it is now, in fact, too late for life as remembered in the Holocene, the only epoch that human civilization has ever known. More recently, Lowell Bliss has framed it in this way: the new future will experience excruciating collapses, catastrophes, and/or extinctions for which our faith in current efforts at activism, sustainability, and/or technological innovation is unfounded. It is neither pessimism nor doomism to admit this. While most of our fellow climate activists focused hopefully on the declining costs of clean energy, we focused on the iron grip of systemic powers. Economic, governmental, and cultural systems. Governments? Last year, the world's governments were planning to produce 45% more fossil fuels than levels consistent with 2 degrees of warming in this century. Of course, they were all promising to keep things at 2 degrees, but their own plans were actually another half more than that, essentially. A year later, however, that number has grown alarmingly to 69% more fossil fuels. Economic systems? A feasible transition away from fossil fuels would expect higher income countries to lead the transition. However, the market has other ideas. The combined levels of coal, oil, gas production being planned by just 10 high income countries alone would already drive the planet beyond 1.5 degrees by 2040. The invisible hand appears to be strangling us. The failures of those two powers are manifest in the basic climate data. In 2023, CO2 emissions from fossil fuels hit an all-time record, rising another 1.1%. And in the current year, the Global Carbon Project reports, as you see here on the slide, there is no sign of the rapid decrease in global emissions that is needed to tackle climate change. The needed acceleration in global efforts to decarbonize the economy is not yet visible in either fossil or land use global emissions trajectories. Unsurprisingly, atmospheric CO2 concentrations continued their rise. They were 427 parts per million in June, up more than 3 points from a year earlier. That's not surprising, as most all of you know. 3 points you can pretty much put in the bank for every year of increase, plus another half point or so every other year or thereabouts. And of course, I don't need to tell us that it's hotter and hotter. And on current trends, the 1.5 degree threshold will be passed in 7 years. And while the eco-realist premise may have appeared to be on the fringe a year ago, it is definitely moving toward the mainstream. Climate anxiety is now a central concern for psychotherapy. 2/3 of Americans now report that they are anxious about climate change, and a shocking 84% of young people do too. 97%, almost all of them, of young people report being very or extremely concerned about the well-being of their existing or future children in a climate-changed world. And this, of course, deters many families from raising many people from raising families, including my own children, who are reluctant to raise families. It may now be time for all of us to consider whether these millions are doomists or if they're simply paying attention to the facts around them. While the systemic powers of extractive capitalism and national government may have failed us, we're concerned today about something else. Our question is about our religious tradition, specifically Christianity for us. Is it ready for what awaits us? I'm not really asking, are Christians ready? For the most part, we already know the answer to that question. Christian climate practitioners and environmentally conscious pastors are familiar with the prevalent unreadiness of our fellow Christians. The popular diagnoses are familiar now, I think, to us all. They go something like this. science is the enemy of faith. We're just passing through. God's in control anyway. The material world doesn't have much significance. And furthermore, what really matters is heaven, not earth. The list goes on, but you end up with a faith community that's particularly vulnerable to ecological denial. That's the diagnosis, more or less, that we've all heard. And virtually all such assessments offer at least one common solution. Christians need to learn their Bibles. Last month, the most effective American Christian climate communicator crystallized this common perspective. It went like this. I really believe that if we took the Bible seriously, if we actually knew what it said, that we would be at the front of the line demanding climate action because it's all through the Bible. Well, I agree with our friends who confront us with the abundance of this worldly narratives in the Hebrew and Christian scriptures. But faced with this assessment, many Christians find themselves in a difficult spot. Our faith tradition is spot on. We ourselves, however, are something of a problem. In survey after survey, we find that our fellow Christians are the least likely to take the ecosystem crisis seriously or to acknowledge it at all. The answers, we are told, are all there in our Bibles if only we would pay attention. But it's a little problematic. Religiously unaffiliated people that these days we call the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, they never pore over their Bibles for their environmental views, but they exceed us by wide margins regarding matters of concern for the earth. This can't be smoothed over. American Christians tend to exhibit far less concern than biblically illiterate secularists on key environmental matters. Is it possible, I think we should ask ourselves, more than just our failure to understand the Bible? What if the problem is within the dominant streams of Christianity themselves? What if our Christianity, not just its imperfect followers, is not ready for what's ahead? Now, I admit this is a difficult question to ask in many communities. For most of us, full belonging depends on affirmation of authoritative, unchanging traditions, most of which present themselves as the truth. But the biblical narrative is replete with instances of listening to contradictory voices from outside the religious hierarchy. For example, Micah tells his people that God doesn't even want sacrifices. And Jesus tells his people, you've heard it say that, but I tell you this. Let me just see, I think we have a slide on this. So if we're willing to do this, it's because we realize that belief systems don't just sit there. They're not content to be true or false. Rather, they function. They determine action. And when a faith community's actions, in this case, our responses to the ecosystem crisis, turn out to be harmful, perhaps it's a sign that we should look at the beliefs that are lurking behind them. Now, I don't presume to tell anybody what they should believe or what they should begin to disbelieve, but with Christians often so resistant to desperately needed action, I've been forced to ask myself that question. If we're willing to take that step, two simple ideas might be helpful. First, we might begin to look outside our tradition for new perspectives. And second, we might look for neglected streams within our tradition that have been cast aside by the logic of Christendom or religious cultural power. From outside the Western tradition, indigenous voices are beginning to be taken seriously. Many of us have come to love Robin Wall Kimmerer's weaving together of indigenous earthbound spirituality with Western science in her masterful book, Braiding Sweetgrass, right? I've already heard it in this room, just a source, however, that more consciously speaks to the eco-realist present is this one. We survived the end of the world. Lessons from Native America on apocalypse and hope. It's the work of the Episcopal Bishop and Choctaw Nation elder, Stephen Charlton. He speaks from the perspective of a people whose world in fact came to an end. From the stories of the American genocide, Charlton asks his fellow Christians to make room for indigenous prophetic perspectives. They include these: a radical reconsideration of Western individualism, a recognition of Earth itself as a living member of a three-way covenant with God and humanity, restructuring of our economies in favor of enough for all, both human and non-human, abandoning all religious exclusivism in favor of a shared destiny among all, a commitment to non-violence without exception, and a willingness to reimagine inherited traditions in light of changing contexts. A second voice comes from outside our Western culture, is coming from Japan, who believe that our faith, from Christians in Japan, who believe that our faith has become ill-suited to times of suffering due to its triumphalism and narratives of violence. Protestant theologian Kosuke Koyama argues that Western Christianity has lost the ability to find hope in the broken Christ of the cross. A strong Western civilization and the weak Christ cannot be reconciled harmoniously. Christ must become strong, a strong United States and a strong Christ. Kanzo Uchimura, founder of the Japanese non-church movement, observed that Westerners love to fight, so when they adopted Christianity, they made it a fighting religion, a European and American religion entirely contrary to its original genius. And Japanese theologian Kazuo Kitamura proposed a theology of the pain of God. While Western cultures embrace triumph and progress, he argued, the deepest impulse of the Japanese mind is expressed as tsurasa, the tragic literary narrative of one who suffers concealed agony and dies for others. For Kitamura, the Japanese heart is not moved by the glory and power of a victorious God, but only by the fellow suffering of Christ on the cross. Thank you. The question asked by these voices is this: what kind of Christianity can speak to those looking into the abyss of ecosystem crisis without drawing them away from this world that God loves? Many Christian environmental thinkers have addressed this conundrum by addition, expanding their inherited religious narratives to make room for earth care, like a new garage apartment added to their houses. The problem, however, is that the call of creation care is often in tension with the inherited expectations of the original structure. We must, we are told, care for the earth, even though many of our most treasured religious assumptions whisper to our hearts, it's really not the main thing, you know. This is where one voice from within our tradition speaks with powerful clarity. Canadian theologian Douglas John Hall insists upon negation. His central concern, the theology of the cross, can only be understood as a negation of commonplace victorious Christian theology. Rather than exclusively arguing the positive, Hall forces us to wrestle with the negative. If this is to be meaningful, it must be not that. Here for our consideration is a smattering of this not that notions that Hall would offer for a world facing unavoidable trauma. Divine solidarity with suffering, not triumph over evil. Willingness to bear the cross of suffering, not expecting victory. Christ, the weakness of God, not Christ, victorious Lord. openness to challenge and criticism, not promotionalism. Welcoming curiosity and dialogue, thank you. Not exceptionalist and authoritative. But there's more. Theological modesty and humility, not claims to ultimacy. Focus on this world, not focus on another world. Solidarity with the creation, not rising above the creation. Focus on Christ imminent here with us, not on Christ above transcendent. Embracing common ground, not exceptional or exclusive. Following Christ into the darkness, not expecting victory over the darkness. Now, there's plenty to wrestle with here, and I don't presume that any one of us will embrace it all. But the critical point here is not agreement, but the willingness to try and reimagine our tradition by listening to new perspectives. Because if American Christians are somehow unprepared for the hard future that we have made, it probably didn't happen by chance. The stakes are incredibly high. We can no longer afford to urge redemptive individual action without recognizing the systemic powers that render our efforts useless. Our economic systems are no longer suited to such a danger, and our culture, including its faith tradition, needs to question itself now with brutal honesty. Is this really working? That's what I'm asking us to do today, to reimagine bravely, willingly enough to ask, is it working? And if you're interested in more of the background on these items, I'm going to leave this slide up. It gives some resources that may be of interest to you if you're looking to learn more about this. Thank you very much, and now I'll do my best to answer any questions that anyone has.
The idea of reimagining some of our traditions, and I also wonder though whether there might be some traditions that we need to rediscover. And like in particular, I'm thinking like the church's tradition of asceticism, right? Simple living. We typically see monastic communities living this way: prayer, fasting, eating very little meat, owning very few things, living and taking up small space, using few things. And I'm wondering, not that we all have to live like monks and nuns, but I wonder if we can kind of take them as role models and try to, I don't know, they seem to have it right. And I'm gonna, if we all kind of lived like that, then we could have, we won't need five earths.
Yeah, thank you. Did you all hear the question? Can we take, borrow from forgotten elements in our tradition, not just neglected ones, but they're sort of related in some ways, aren't they? And you'll note that I have included here some voices, but there are so many voices. Why didn't I give some of this presentation to Celtic spirituality? Why didn't I look to Eastern Orthodox spirituality? And why didn't I think about monastic? They're all there. And what it does, what is true though, is that none of them look very much like North Atlantic 21st century Christianity. Yes.
Yeah, when you mentioned Charleston, your slide had a bullet about religious exclusivism.
Yeah.
Can you just expand on that and tell me more about how you would describe that?
Well, yes. Here we were talking about some of the inputs from the indigenous communities. And many of the prophetic works of during the American Holocaust coming out of the indigenous world were open both to settler Christianity on the one hand, and as well as indigenous religion as well. You have lots of people who are dual belonging believers in the indigenous world. They're not exclusive that way. You know, sometimes I pray, "Our Father who art in heaven." Other times I pray like this, and now you're going to hear something totally different and foreign to you. And so that's an inclusive, welcoming perspective. Yeah, so, sure, yeah. Yes?
Yeah, like for making the church focusing on our church or focusing on kind of changing the broader systems.
Yeah. Thank you. Again, I think that you spoke well and clearly enough that people could hear. Should we be focusing on ourselves internally, or should we be focusing on convincing our churches to begin taking the ecological crisis seriously? In a way, you're asking the wrong person. I'm sorry, but theologians don't have answers. They're asked for answers. What they can offer are ways of thinking, habits of thinking. Going out, and so if the habit you're hearing here is go back and read Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. What does it say about the ecological crisis? Nothing. But what does it say about indigenous people? Well, it's starting to tell you something, right? And so to my mind is a posture of theological openness is a way to begin to transform the thing of your two choices that I would really lean toward. I've given up on trying to change the church. That was my goal at one point in time. I broke my pick. Now I'm trying to change me, and I'm thinking about new ways to understand my Christian faith. And so that's, I guess, where I would leave it.
You have
so
it one more. Really fast.
Yeah.
Like 10 seconds.
Okay, well, to begin with, it's not the main thing is what everybody hears when they're working in the arenas of justice, because the great thing about a religion is that anything other than what one regards as the central focus of that religion is not the main thing. So you can have eternity or you can do something else. So this is the problem that religious people, not just our tradition, you know, if this were in a mosque and I were giving the same, it would be the same phenomenon, right? There's all those other things are not the main thing. And that's the way lots of people get forced out of whatever justice ministry they're engaged in. Yeah. Thank you for that comment. I appreciate it.
Anything else? Do it offline. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Sharon.